The Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 32 of The Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, a poor player who plans to strut and fret my hour upon the podcast and then heard no more. Until next week, I'll be heard next week, because I'm always back on next week, and I say that as someone who's waited 2 weeks to drop this podcast, because I've been sick. I've been coughing and sneezing with the mucus and the sneezing and the bad feelings. But I'm all better now. Yes, I'm in the pink. I'm jumping about like a cartoon gymnast and breathing freely pretty much, only occasionally sneezing and coughing. And what I do, just politely turn your head away from your iPod, because I would hate for you to catch anything. As a matter of fact, it might be best if you just listen to the entire thing with one of those surgical masks on, just to be on the safe side, because I'm nothing if not safe. I believe in safe podcasts. That's why I always use condiments with my... reached for it, missed it. I reached too high and missed it completely. So let's just forget that ever happened and move on. Today is a little bit different for the podcast. Normally we'll have people on who will talk about a range of subjects, and we will leap from pillar to post and from hither to yon and talk about this and that. And today we're pretty much honed in. My guest is a wonderful writer named Glenn Frankel, and he has published a book that I truly admire. It's called The Searchers, The Making of an American Legend. And as you might guess from the title, it's about John Ford's great 1956 film, The Searchers, starring John Wayne and Jeffrey Hunter and Natalie Wood. And generally considered to be one of the most influential films, especially on filmmakers of the 70s and 80s, as we discuss in this. Almost every young punk filmmaker, those ne'er-do-wells like Spielberg and Scorsese and Coppola, they all looked on The Searchers as being a huge influence on them. This book not only tells the story of John Ford's film and how it came to be made and what kind of impact it had, but it also tells the true story on which it was, I'd say loosely based, but based, about the kidnapping of a young girl in 1836. Her name was Cynthia Ann Parker. She was kidnapped by the Comanches and endured a pretty rough go there with them for quite a while. But then after living with them for 24 years, when she was rescued, brought back to white society, she mourned her time with the Comanches and wanted to go back and never felt like she was really a part of society anymore. It's a really sad and fascinating story. And one of her sons, Kawana Parker, was one of the last real Comanche chiefs. So it turns into a whole history of the West, so this is a fascinating book. I highly recommend it, and I believe I brown-nosed Glenn quite a bit in the course of this interview, telling him just how much I like it, because I do. It's readable, it's fun, it's interesting, and I like it a lot. So Glenn himself is a guy that I like quite a lot, and we had a good talk, and I sound even more nasally in the interview than I do now, but I was sicker then, so forgive me. And forgive me, Glenn, if I gave you something during the interview. I hope I didn't sneeze your way. So please enjoy this interview with Glenn Frankel, and I will see you on the other side. And I can honestly say that you're my first Pulitzer Prize winner. So that's a red letter day for this podcast.
Well, you know, it isn't a Pulitzer Prize though for writing books or for writing about film. It was out there in the field covering the Middle East conflict, basically the first Palestinian intifada. So, I mean, I'm proud to have that Pulitzer. I'm not giving it back, but, you know, take it for what it's worth.
Well, it seems to be worth a lot. Now, how long were you in the Middle East for all this stuff?
Well, I worked for the Washington Post for 27 years. And after starting out as a local reporter, I was lucky enough to get an overseas assignment in Southern Africa. And then we moved to Jerusalem. This would have been way back, 1986. And we spent 3 years there. I say we, it was my wife and I, and then our two daughters. We added a third child in Jerusalem. We were there till 89. I won the Pulitzer for work I did in 1988, covering the first Palestinian intifada, which was an amazing experience. Then we left and went to London for 3 years. Then we came back to Jerusalem, and I wrote a book about Israel. So I've got a long, tangled history with Israel that goes back a long way.
Wow, that's, yeah, it sounds like it. That must have been, I mean, were you ever in any danger during all this?
Well, these were mostly in the days before the exploding passenger buses, those kinds of sort of terror campaign. In my time, it was more, you know, the Israeli army had all the firepower. The Palestinian kids had rocks and bottles and burning tires and that sort of thing. So if you discreetly positioned yourself in the right place, you wouldn't be behind the people who were being shot at. You'd be somewhere else. I'm a famous coward. I mean, I would always park the car facing out to leave a zone. Mm-hmm. I never wore any kind of khakis or any of that kind of dramatic, bold, you know, vests that photographers wear or great foreign correspondents who are dashing people wear. I always wore nerdy looking, you know, pants and tried to look as harmless and nerdy as possible, which is to say tried to look like who I really am. So I'm of the variety, I consider myself a pretty boring person who's been lucky enough to have a pretty interesting life.
It sounds like it. Always stay out of harm's way. That's my motto.
I'll buy that for sure. For a while, I wouldn't travel with photographers at all because they're always looking for action.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
And I'm not looking for action. I'm happy to interview the people afterwards about the action.
Now, what I find interesting about this book, the book on the searchers, is that you don't seem to have that much of a track record in film history. So
none at all.
Yeah. So tell me how it came about that you decided to look into this particular film.
Well, you know, as a former foreign correspondent, you have to have a certain level of fearlessness about subject matter, which is to say, ignorance is no, you know, inhibition.
Yeah.
Because you're always going new places and you're always doing what you can do. But in fact, my history with the searchers goes back a long, long time. I saw it as a kid, probably on TV the first time, because I don't think my parents would have let me see it at age 6. In a theater. So I saw it around age 10 or 12. I remember seeing Hondo at around that time, a few other things. Even then I knew that The Searchers was one big cut above Hondo, let's say. But then I saw it again when I was at Columbia University. Andrew Saras, you know, at the Village Voice, the famed auteurist who, you know, imported the auteur theory from Paris. This was the first year he taught an introductory film course at Columbia. It was on Thursday evenings in the basement of Butler Library, and I was there the first year he did it. And, you know, Saras, among other things, was all about sort of rehabilitating, you know, opinions about people like Alfred Hitchcock, Howard Hawks, John Ford. We all thought the great artistes were people like Fellini or, you know, Truffaut and Godard. And Saras showed those films as well. But he was explaining to us his view that Hawks and Ford and Hitchcock were also artists, were also great cinematic directors, and that they were responsible for most of what we saw in their films. And he showed The Searchers. And I remember it had quite an impact on me. I've always thought about it. I've seen it many times since then. I bought the novel at one point and read that at least 20 years ago. And so it occurred to me that I would write about it someday. I always thought I would do a kind of making of the movie book, you know, which doesn't involve having great knowledge of cinema or film criticism, God knows. It's a reporting issue. You go out and talk to everybody, you gather all the material you can, you figure out a narrative that works, and that would be that. And I assumed that that was the kind of book I could do about The Searchers. I knew it was in the tradition of the American captivity narrative that there was such a thing. I figured there'd probably be a chapter somewhere near the beginning of that book of that kind of context, you know, to put the film and the film's concerns in context. But I never dreamed that the book would go beyond the making of a movie to go back into American history in the way that it did, and to spend so much time talking about, you know, the fact that it was loosely based on a true story. Once I got there, I was much more in my milieu, in a sense, because there, too, it was all about research, it was all about reporting, getting out there, finding out as much information as I could. So at that point, it didn't matter if I had film history or not. I was pretty comfortable doing a bit of American history.
Did you end up talking to anybody who had worked on the film?
Yes, I did. Not as many people as I would have liked, so many of them are gone now. But I met Harry Carey Jr. at his home in Santa Barbara in 2009. I interviewed Pippa Scott around that same time here in L.A. I met relatives of people, Dan Ford, who's John Ford's grandson and the author of a wonderful memoir called Pappy, was very helpful to me and gave me several interviews. Kevin Nugent, who was the son of Frank Nugent, the screenwriter. Kevin has since died, but I interviewed Kevin twice about his father, who's been long gone, who passed away in mid-1960s. So people connected in one way or the other. And finally, Alan LeMay, the novelist who wrote The Searchers, had died again in 1964-65, but his son Dan and his daughter Molly are here, and they actually, Dan was in the process of collecting information about his father and was incredibly helpful and generous, and I interviewed them, of course, about their father. So I gathered up the few original people I could find. Really wanted to interview Vera Miles, but Vera Miles has been kind of missing in action for a long time, her choice. And so I didn't get a chance to see her. I'd still like to meet Vera Miles and talk to her about The Searchers. Maybe she'll dial up and listen to the blog and we'll get something going.
I'm sure she listens to every episode.
Absolutely.
How could she not? I knew the bare bones of the Cynthia Ann Parker story, but not nearly as much as, of course, you write about in this book. It was fascinating. And, of course, as an Alamo guy and all the books I've written on the Alamo, it does tie in very neatly with the Texas Revolution and the runaway scrape and all that stuff. For people who don't know it, what do you give at least the synopsis of that story, that Cynthia Ann Parker was kidnapped, like Little Debbie, and tell us a little bit about how all that happened.
Yeah, that's exactly right. She comes from a family, you know, the Parkers are sort of your great backwoods farming, you know, American settlement story. They begin in Virginia, they work their way south for a while, then they start heading west after the Revolution. They're kicking down the doors, you know, to the western frontier all the way through. They end up in Illinois. Each place, you know, they wear out the soil, they wear out their welcome sometimes, and they head someplace new. And in the 1833, 1834, they set their sights on Texas, and a number of them left Illinois and headed down the Mississippi along the trail and end up crossing over into Texas. At that point, they're still offering large tracts of land to settle Texas, the government of Mexico. Texas was a colony of Mexico at that point. Stephen F. Austin had opened up settlement. He had created a system of impresarios where people would come down, get large tracts, invite other people to join them, kind of like big housing developments. And the Parkers settled in East Texas. They had a split. Daniel Parker, a Baptist preacher, decided to nestle close to the other East Texas settlements because he wanted to have to preach, and he wanted to have, you know, a congregation. Whereas his younger brother, a couple of his younger brothers actually, Silas and James, decided to settle a little closer to Indian territory, to where there were villages, but also raiding grounds of Comanches and Kiowas and nomads who would come down every spring. Well, they built a fortified settlement called Old Fort Parker, but it was rather, and in good territory, wonderful soil, good water, but rather close to Indian territory. And sure enough, You mentioned the runaway scrape. I mean, basically, in 1836, Texas underwent the Revolution. After the Alamo fell, Santa Anna's troops started heading up to the north and the east. The Parkers and other settlers in that area fled to get away from Santa Anna. They were delivered, if you will, by Sam Houston and the army that defeated Santa Anna. But there wasn't a lot of time there to plant. So they rushed back to the settlement. They started planting corn in a desperate attempt to get corn by the, you know, seed corn down to harvest it in the fall. But they left the gates of the fort open. A number of Comanches and Kiowas show up one day in May 1836. They attack the settlement. They kill 5 men. They kidnap 5 young people, including 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker, and they haul them off to Comancheria, this vast area so around the Texas Panhandle, the sort of limestone plains. They split up the abductees. Cynthia Ann gets taken by a group of Comanches. We don't know much about what happened to her. She, unlike many captives, leaves no narrative, and there's no real good interview with her, so we don't know what happened, but surely she was adopted by a Comanche family. They had low birth rates. They lost many children. It wasn't easy being a nomadic warrior out in the limestone plains of Texas. And so she surely was adopted. She grew up, like Little Debbie, to become a Comanche woman. She married a warrior, very likely a warrior who was involved in that original raid, though we're not sure about that. And she spends 24 years with the Comanches. She has 3 children, 2 boys and a little girl. And what happens is 24 years later, there's a second raid on an area where she's living, only this time, rather than, you know, Native Americans attacking, the attackers are a group of Texas Rangers and U.S. Cavalry. And they kill a bunch of people, and they grab this woman who looks like a Comanche, and they point a gun at her, but they look closely, and it turns out she's got blue eyes. And so rather than kill her, they take her and her little baby daughter, who was with her at the time, and they haul her back to Camp Cooper in North Texas. And they're kind of aware that she may be the sort of legendary Cynthia Ann Parker, this person who's been heard about for years but not seen. They call her Uncle Isaac, who comes from an area outside of Fort Worth, and he gets in his wagon and rides up there to Camp Cooper. And sure enough, when they start talking to her, she stands up at one point and pounds her own chest and says, "Me, Cindy Ann." And so there she is. And Uncle Isaac takes her back to the Parker family homes in North Texas. And she becomes something of a celebrity. Now stop me if I'm going on too long, Frank, but I'll keep going to explain what happens next, which is to say, you know, they show her off a bit. There are a lot of newspaper stories about her. Uncle Isaac actually takes her down to Austin to appear before the Texas State Legislature. He wants to get her a league of land and an annuity. But she's up there in the gallery at the state legislature. She's in good dress for the first time. Remember, this is a woman who for 24 years wore clothes that didn't have buttons. She's all Comanche. She's scared to death. And she's looking down from the gallery at these white men, old men, who are looking up at her. And she's sure that there's some kind of judge, some kind of court, and that they're judging whether to hang her or not for being a Comanche. And she tries to flee. And increasingly, Uncle Isaac and the other members of the Parker family begin to realize that she's not very happy to have been restored to her white family, to be back in the fold of Christendom. You know, redemption isn't really working for her. She wants to be back with the Comanches. She wants to be back with her husband and her boys. And she's desperately unhappy. So gradually we stop hearing about her. Less newspaper stories, then no newspaper stories. And the Parkers actually send her off to Anderson County. They have a sawmill there. She works with her sister's husband, you know, and she disappears from the history books. We don't know exactly when she died. There's no obituary of Cynthia Ann Parker. There's a great story that, you know, she died of a broken heart in 1864. The only problem with that is there's an 1870 census in which she's there as part of the Parker family in Anderson County. We think she died somewhere between then and 1875. But you can see some of the parallels here for people who are familiar with the searchers. There's some things that are very similar here and then some things that are very, very different.
Sure. Well, the searching uncle which of course is accentuated in The Searchers. And but it also points toward what I've always felt was the real bitter ending of The Searchers, which is not only that Ethan Edwards is not restored to family and hearth and home, but in a way you have to look at little Debbie when she goes back in and think, what kind of life is she going back to? Because it really does seem like a completely ambiguous thing. And as we know, Cynthia Ann Parker was not happy to come back. And because the people would have seen her as tainted, right? I mean,
yes. There were, as I suggested earlier, the captivity narrative was the first American literary genre and really one of the most enduring ones of all. James Fenimore Cooper and The Last of the Mohicans. I mean, these stories of these true life stories of women who were kidnapped. The first bestseller in America was probably Mary Rowlandson's 1682 account of her captivity.
Right.
So these things are out there, and it's always and often they involve women and children, you know, and virginal purity and what happens to them, and the question of a fate worse than death, which is kidnapped by Indians who then proceed who force you to have sex with them.
Yeah.
This was something in the American psyche, in the settler psyche, that was horrifying to contemplate. And so women who were brought across this border, if you will, who were dragged across it involuntarily, it was very hard for them to come back. In fairness, I don't think Cynthia Ann's family, her Texan family, disowned her or were, you know, mean to her. They didn't understand her. They didn't know what it would take to make her satisfied. They didn't understand her lack of gratitude. I saw an interview with Uncle Isaac. It's located at Sahana. It's a typed out thing and never published in, you know, at the University of Texas Archives, where he's explaining long later how sad he was when he came to understand how miserable she was. And he says at one point, "I feel terrible. We should have left her with the Comanches. She would have lived a long time. She'd still be alive," he said, if that. Mm. And I think he's absolutely right. She could not readjust to being in white society. It wasn't so much that she was shunned. It's simply that there was no communication, no comprehension across those lines. Now, in the Searchers, in both the novel by Alan LeMay and the film, the focus has changed from the abductee, if you will, to the family searching for her later. Her Uncle James searched for her for 7 or 8 years unsuccessfully. Well, LeMay changes the focus in Ford as well. And you see, you know, at the end of the film, you see a wary look in Natalie Wood's eyes as she's brought back, but you don't know where that's going to turn out. Because John Ford isn't concerned about that. That's not really what he's focusing on. He's focusing on the impact of all of this violence and all of these terrible deeds on the survivors, on the searchers, on the remaining members of the family. That's what he does so well and so differently than I think is in the original story.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting about your book and some other books that I've coincidentally been reading fairly recently is, to put it in a nutshell, that a lot of the Plains Indians, and especially the Comanches, were incredibly violent people, and violent for fun, and violent for sport. And when they captured these people, you know, what the stories you tell about the original attack on Fort Parker, it was horrible what they did. I mean, they, and often laughing and just having a great time as they did it. And it really flies in the face of, what I think especially since the 1950s and 60s, we've had this general, looking at the American Indian as victim only, as the genocidal victims of people who were held the land sacred, and when in fact there's all sorts of stories of them just shooting buffalo for sport and leaving the carcasses to rot and that sort of thing, that flies in the face of this, for lack of a better term, this ironized Cody tear dropping down the cheek
yes.
image that we've gotten, because they were tough people. And
Well, they were in tough circumstances. As I say, living in the limestone plains of Texas, wasn't a lot of, you know, wherewithal there. You had to be tough. So there wasn't many resources. They shared them among themselves. They had a great sense of kinship. And if they kidnapped you and you were of a certain age, they would adopt you and you could become part of that. But if you weren't of that age, you were in trouble. If you were a baby and you were holding up the war, you know, the raiding party from getting back where it needed to go, you weren't going to last very long. And there are a couple of those things in my book that are very sad and horrifying. And by the same token, if you were older, the best you could hope for was to be a servant or a slave, really, to the great, you know, empire of, you know, of producing and processing bison, or of taking care of the vast horse herds. They were such wonderful horsemen, and they were a war machine, no question. So they treated their own kind with great kindness and gentleness, but they treated outsiders sometimes horribly. And remember, these are the days before MTV or home entertainment, and unfortunately there were times when the home entertainment for these folks was the mutilation and the torture of captives. If you were a brave person and if you spit in their eye, they would kill you quickly out of respect. And there was a whole belief system behind all of this. You know, you form an ideology to deal with the physical circumstances you deal with. But if you were, you know, cowardly about it or easily pushed around or, you know, soft or begging, it could play out quite a while. I think these were the circumstances, and I think we have to accept the reality of that, and at the same time, that they were in what turned out to be a 40-year protracted war, the longest war on American soil, with Texas, with the Texans. And neither side gave quarter in this war. Both sides treated the children and the families of the other side not just as, you know, collateral damage. Oh, sorry, I killed your mother. That was the target.
Yeah.
The goal was annihilation of the other side. Savage war of peace, in Rudyard Kipling's term. And so the goal, as I say, was to destroy the culture, destroy the family, destroy everything about the other side, because this was an existential war. One side was going to win and one side was going to lose.
Yeah, it's really a brutal experience. And I think even John Ford, who I think he gives a lot more balance than maybe the true story would warrant, because there is a certain sympathy from Ford to all the Indians in all of his films, almost all. They're kind of faceless in Stagecoach, but after that, they're almost always characters. They're almost always characters with nuance, and often characters with which the, let's say, John Wayne character in several of the films, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, so forth, actually has a friendly relationship and an understanding relationship, because they understand that they're the same kind of people, you know?
Yes. Well, another one, besides the fate worse than death, another tradition is the man who knows Indians.
Yes.
And John Wayne is often playing that role. Sometimes the man who knows Indians is an Indian fighter, and even an Indian hater. And sometimes he's very sympathetic. Ford blows hot and cold. I think a lot depends on who the screenwriter is in a particular movie. For example, you know, in Rio Grande, it's you know, the Indians there are treated, you know, very badly. I mean, they're just barbarians, they're criminals, they're murderers. Whereas, you know, in She Wore a Yellow
Ribbon, but Henry Fonda is worse.
Yeah, well, in Fort Apache, though, yeah, Cochise is treated with great respect. Searchers is a little bit of both, isn't it? Because they are rapists and killers, and they kill the Edwards family. You know, they do horrifying things to the Edwards family, including the women at the beginning. Later on, you see some of the motives for that, and you see a Comanche village where people have been slaughtered by Custer's 7th Cavalry, and you see the bodies of men and women. However, you don't meet those people the way you've met the Edwards family. You have enormous sympathy for the Edwardses at the beginning of the movie because we know who they are. You don't get that same kind of explanation of the Comanches. You do begin to see the Wayne character, Ethan Edwards, the uncle, and the Comanche warrior Scar, the evil warrior, as two sides of the same coin, especially in that wonderful scene where they finally meet up outside Scar's tent, and they trade insults. And it's clear that that Ford sees them as two sides of the same coin, two very scarred warriors, if you will, wounded beyond redemption in some ways, feeding off the hatred of each other. So, you know, Ford is doing a lot of interesting things here. So there's some sympathy for Native Americans, but I wouldn't say, but it's not Cheyenne Autumn, which comes later, where Ford really tries to make amends, I think, for some of this. He uses the Comanches as the other. He uses them as our nightmare in many ways, and they are. They're very powerful. They're magnificent, but they're, not to put a 2 point on it, barbarians as far as the searchers is concerned. And, you know, we're not rooting for them. We're rooting for the searchers.
The closest Ford gets to trying to construct a sympathetic Indian character is Look, the girl who becomes the de facto squaw of Martin.
She's the inadvertent bride. Martin picks, you know, gets her accidentally in some trade where he doesn't know what he's doing.
And it's a strange, it's one of the uncomfortable things about the movie to me, because she is in many ways a very sympathetic character, a very likable and good character, and a helpful character who really does care for Martin. But you can't help but feel that Ford is treating her with total contempt. I mean, she's just this buffoon, this comic, the butt of the joke.
Yes, and that's absolutely true. She's an interesting character, and she's very loyal to Martin, and she does him a very good deed in the end. But, you know, The Searchers is a very unsettling movie. There are things about it that don't go down easy, that are hard to figure, and this is one of the most difficult moments. At one point, Martin, you know, frustrated with her, kicks her in the butt and knocks her down a hill. Well, I think this is Ford, frankly, who kicked a few people in the butt over the years, including Harry Carey Jr. and a few others, and thought it was fun. Thought it was humorous. And I think he thinks that Martin's kicking Look is a humorous moment.
I think so too.
And it's not. No, it's not. It is the one moment, I think, unredeemable moment in the film. I'm willing to analyze everything else, you know, and to explain away. I think, you know, Ford was a paternalist. He treated the Navajo who he worked with on the set, he paid them well. He loved them, you know, but as the great white father, if you will. One of the great moments for him is, you know, they're in Monument Valley shooting The Searchers. And it's 4th of July, and Ford puts on a big sort of, you know, rodeo, and they kill a cow, and they, you know, and he's paying for all this. And the Navajo give him a deerskin that for him that says addressed to Natani Nez, the tall chief. And Ford loves this, and he wrapped himself in this thing, and he really, you know, tears were in his eyes. I talked to Harry Carey Jr. about this. I said, "Is this for real?" And he said, "Yes." That for Ford, this meant a lot. This, you know, having this kind of relationship. So Ford, you know, he both has killed off a lot of Native Americans, as he told Peter Bogdanovich at one point. I killed, you know, more than anybody else. But at the same time, he thinks they're noble, noble people, and he pays them their due. It's not simple, but in Searchers, it's both complex and very compelling.
Yeah, I think that's the part about Ford that is so hard to get a grasp on in some ways. And I've talked with others on this podcast about it. Joe McBride had a lot to say about this. That Ford, for having the heart, the gentlest heart of a poet, apparently, and as you see in film after film, these beautiful, sentimental and emotionally fulfilling films, could apparently be just such a bastard in almost every interpersonal relationship he had, and was genuinely cruel to people often, even people who he, I mean, what he did with Harry Carey. I mean, he actually broke one of his ribs one time, and did all sorts of things like that. That goes beyond horseplay. That goes beyond anything. And so, when I see that, I think one of the cringeworthy things about the scene with Look getting kicked down the hill is that you do get the feeling that Ford thinks that this is a funny thing to do to somebody. And especially somebody who's innocent and doesn't deserve it.
Yeah, there
is
that.
Which is the worst part. You know?
You're right. Well, Ford was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
To say the least, he had trouble expressing his feelings. And as he drank, it got harder, and it was easier for him to be abusive. I also am afraid that when people loved Ford, this was something Ford couldn't really accept. That he lashed out often at the people who really did love him, and among those, John Wayne.
Yeah.
He treats Wayne often abusively. Wayne is a very loyal customer, and he felt a great debt to Ford because, of course, after Wayne has an early career mostly in B movies and it's not going so well, Ford casts him as the Ringo Kid in the Stagecoach in basically the first great Wayne movie. And Wayne was, as I say, a very loyal man. He appreciated what Ford had done for him then. He also appreciated the fact that when he was working with Ford, he was doing good work. He was in great movies. He was being stretched himself. He was really acting. So he had a lot of time for Ford. Ford had his phone number, literally, and could call him up on any project, whether it was making a movie in Monument Valley or it was appearing at some sort of Christmas pageant, you know, back in Hollywood.
Sure.
Wayne would be there for Ford. But Ford repaid him with a lot of verbal abuse. Ford admired Wayne greatly, thought he was very talented, really came to respect his talent. But at the same time, even in Searchers, which is, you know, after they've known each other for 26 years or so, Ford's still abusing him on the set, still yelling at him, when are you going to learn to ride a horse, you know? All that kind of stuff, which Wayne took, because that was the kind of person Wayne was.
Well, the scenes about Luke, in addition to being just cruel, also point out my only other major problem with the Searchers, and I wonder how you feel about it, and that is that in every sense, every time Ford goes for comedy, it's always awful. And Ken Curtis, who I like in so many things, is so horrible in this movie. And that accent is so high school hillbilly.
They call it a Colorado dryland accent. And it's actually Jeff Hunter who did it first, you know, in fun out there one evening in Monument Valley. And Ford overhears it and says, I love that. I want that.
I'm sure he thought it was funny, but man, oh man, and I find that to be pretty consistent across the board with Ford, is that his humor just doesn't quite connect. Sometimes it does, I guess, because he made so many movies that you gotta hit it sometimes, but the Searchers, I think, those scenes are what keeps the Searchers from being the true masterpiece that it almost is to me. I know a lot of people believe that it's the most important American film, and maybe it is. I mean, maybe it's certainly the most influential film, but those things really count against it in so many ways to me.
Well, let me say a couple of things about that. The novel is a wonderful novel by Alan LeMay. It came out in 1954. It's relentlessly grim. There's no humor in that novel. Charlie McCrory is in the novel, but he's not any fun. Ford knew he couldn't do that, didn't want to do that. Maybe you could do that today, but you couldn't really do that. It's something that grim and relentless in 1955 when they shot the film. Ford was trying to expand its dimensions. My wife agrees with you totally, incidentally, but I don't totally, because those scenes, you know, that humor, Charlie McCrory's accent aside, what Ford's doing is, besides leavening the incredible tension and the darkness of the main plot, he's also giving you a sense of community and a sense of warmth and intimacy among this small, beleaguered community of Texicans out on the border, in borderland, you know, facing all of these obstacles, including the Comanches, but not just the Comanches. And Ford, as you know, he's a great lover of community. He's a great lover. There's always a dance in a Ford movie. There's always music. There's always humor. Those things all go together, I think. Joe McBride, who's a huge Ford advocate, will describe it as Shakespearean. It's like Falstaff. There's the Mose Harper character, who's the wise fool, who's very much out of Shakespeare. All those things are going on, and I think they're a matter of taste. I think there are a number of people and a number of young people who will look at that film today and who will laugh at it because of those moments and will not accept that it's a great work of art. I think my daughter's one of those. Jonathan Lethem wrote an essay called, you know, Defending the Searchers, in which he was mortified when people of his age were laughing at those moments, not in a good way. I see them as important, as I say, in establishing the community they're in. I think there is some light touch there. I think having Ethan be part of that, the grim warrior, and yet Ethan has a sense of humor too, and can be very charming. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. I think it's important to understand that the racism about Native Americans and the feeling of vengeance wasn't just confined to Ethan, the avenging uncle, but in fact was a community norm.
Sure.
And you see that partly through these kinds of scenes. So, again, I'm not going to defend it per se, but I think it actually, with a few notable exceptions, I think it adds to the richness of the movie, because I think it takes it beyond simply the mission, and it gives you the context of the world they're in and the people who are there. And, you know, Searchers in One Interpretation, to me, is a struggle between hatred and love. And so to see you see the hatred. You see Wayne on this mission of vengeance, you know, and murder, really, and justice, sort of, frontier justice. You have to see the other side of that coin. You have to see this loving community that sticks together, that tries to help each other, you know, that has the dance together and a wedding, you know, these rare events. You have to see some of that to understand what's really at stake in the movie.
Oh, I'm totally with you about the scenes of community and all that stuff, which I think is great. It's just the comedy stuff that bothers me and always has. But that being said, that's only a sliver off how great I think this movie is. And it does have some of the most compelling imagery of any film. And one of the films, as if he needs it anymore, although he kind of still does, to prove to people what a great actor John Wayne was. And I've talked about this on more than one occasion on this show, but I get really fed up with people condescending to him about, oh, he was just being himself, or as Michael Wayne once said to me, my dad never played a rich movie star in a movie. and I think that's pretty well said. But I think more than just being a compelling persona and character that people liked, I think he was a genuinely good actor. And I think he's a genuinely great actor. One of the best there ever was.
I totally agree with you. I think one of the problems is that for many of us, you know, the Wayne we knew growing up was that 1960s, early 70s guy, overweight, the funny toupee, playing the same role, usually, not always, but often for second-rate directors, directing himself. But the earlier Wayne, the Wayne who worked with Howard Hawks and John Ford, the young, more lithe character, is such an interesting character. Wayne himself was quite clear-cut that, you know, this was an invention, this persona, the screen was something he created over time. And when you see his early films, when you see Big Trail, which he starred in 1930, it was an early attempt at stardom that failed because Big Trail flopped. And it propelled him back, you know, into B-Westerns for almost a decade.
Sure.
But you see him in that, you see him in the B-Westerns, and you see someone trying to figure out a character, trying to create a persona. And it takes him some time, and he borrows a little bit here and a little bit there from people, from Harry Carey Sr., you know, from Yakima Canute, who was a great stuntman. But he's developing this slow-talking, slow pigeon-toed walking, you know, man with lethal power who could be your friend and would be a very loyal friend, but if you crossed him or if you, you know, crossed the line, this whole persona was an invention of Wayne's. And, you know, it seems so, quote, natural, unquote, but it wasn't that at all. It really was something that he put together over time. And it was very effective. But the other beauty of Wayne, of course, is he would act against it at times. He would go against the grain of that. When he was working with Howard Hawks in Red River, or he's working with John Ford in The Searchers, he's willing to go much darker and much deeper. And he's totally convincing in those roles because he knows what to do. He's an actor. And anyone who's seen Red River, seen Searchers, you know, seen some of the other Ford films, seen The Quiet Man. Yeah. You know, it's all there. It's a great creation, and I totally agree with you. I used to say, I love The Searchers, and I think John Wayne's terrific in it, even though I don't generally care for John Wayne. He's really good in that. I could see that from the beginning. Sure. But gradually, of course, as I've studied Wayne and I went back and saw everything, and I even took a course in John Wayne at Stanford University when I was teaching there. it was a great course. You know, you see the reality that you're describing of a man building his craft. And in the relatively new medium of film, he becomes one of the real first great movie stars because he has an understanding of what film is and what acting is for film that goes beyond almost any other actor. And that's why he's so famous.
And you look at The Searchers, and there are several moments in that film in which he doesn't say a word, and yet he's telling you everything you need to know about what he's thinking and what he's feeling. When Martin refuses to rest his horse and goes riding off, and Wayne knows, or Ethan Edwards knows, that he has to rest the horse, but he wants to go back. And just that look on his face as he's watching Martin right away, or when they're seeing the women who have been recovered from the Indian village, and he hears one woman just spouting gibberish, and that look of disgust and pity and anger, who knows what, I mean, it's just all these things, but just this one look, he doesn't say anything, and it's remarkable. He's really something.
I've seen that scene many, many, many a time. I think we must have watched it at least a dozen times just in that one course. And you're right, it's not easy. I think the first few times you see it, you're there and you conclude, well, this is when he's decided he's going to kill Debbie when he finds her. He has to do it. But really, when you examine his expressions, I think you're absolutely right, Frank. I mean, there's more than one emotion there. There's some pity, there's some anger, there's some hatred. There's a bit of despair, like, what am I going to do now? I'm way out of my, you know, normal process here. I don't know what to do. And when he turns away from that, the other thing I've noticed, his shoulders sag a bit. Mm. There's a burden that he's feeling that is really complicated, and I don't think he knows what he's going to do. He really, for the first time almost, Ethan Edwards, the indomitable man, faces something that he has trouble processing. Because he doesn't want to kill this little girl. It's his niece. It's, you know, it's Debbie. But at the same time, the forces that are driving him and his own sense of despair. And I think that's what you see. And you can only see that from a man, from an actor who really knows what he's doing. And that's proof as far as I'm concerned.
What do you think it is about this film that's made it so incredibly influential? Because there was a time, maybe the 70s, I would say, with that group of brilliant wunderkinds who came up, Spielberg and Lucas and Scorsese and all these guys, and they're all under the sway of The Searchers. And probably more so than subsequent generations who are under the sway of The Searchers secondhand through Scorsese and Coppola and Spielberg and so forth. But what do you think it is about the film that made it so incredibly influential to these young filmmakers?
Well, first of all, they saw it at a point in their lives, roughly when I saw it. Mm. So it really marks them very early when they're, you know, in their early teens or a little later. These guys are all thinking about becoming filmmakers then. And this movie, I think it's the combination of the visual beauty. That Ford is such an artistic director. You know, for a guy who never did storyboards, he frames things beautifully. He's got a great cameraman in Winton Hawk working with him on this.
Sure.
But everything as an artist, you know, there's visual artistry there that's just extraordinary. There's great emotional power, because this is a movie about love and hate, and Ford understands that. He's willing to go very dark. It's also a movie about rape. It's about the terrible things that happened to his characters and the impact of that terrible violence on the survivors. So it's a real, there's trauma, there's something very deep and dramatic going on. And I think, again, on these three guys and other young directors at the time, it really imprinted itself. and there's moral complexity as well. The interesting thing, you know, when it came out in 1956, it got pretty good reviews. I think it finished number 11 in the box office that year, but nobody really got it. Nobody really understood how complex it was. They thought it was like, well, a pretty good John Ford, John Wayne, cowboy and Indian movie.
Mm-hmm.
It only took the next generation, if you will, coming after Vietnam, coming in a different era, to begin to notice all the subtleties that were going on and all the contradictions at the heart of it, and to really feel unsettled by it. Scorsese talks about this, how unsettling the movie was for him when he first saw it. He was mesmerized by it, but it also frightened him in a way. I felt horrified by some of it, but it was so real. Even the gunshots sounds seemed more real somehow than in the average cowboy movie.
Yeah.
You know, I think that was. I think they were impressed by its seeming authenticity, by its beauty, and by the real deep emotions it was raising.
I think when you present the kind of moral complexities that this film presents, that it digs deeper into the brain and the imagination, because it does on some level have a happy ending. He doesn't kill his niece. He rescues her. He brings her back to the arms of her family. But as we said earlier, he can't come back in, and we have grave doubts that she's going to assimilate. So it's a starkly tragic story that turns light, that still has these strong edges of darkness to it, even at the end, when on some level it seems like it's ended well, that, okay, everything turned out like it should have, but it points toward an uncertain future.
I think that's true, and I think that's part of its strength. You know, David Thompson, the film critic David Thompson, who's not a great John Ford Western fan at
mm-hmm.
all, and yet he finds the ending of The Searchers to be one of the most powerful moments in American cinema. One thing Thompson said at one point, every time I watch this film, I'm not sure what's going to happen. And that's a tribute, I think, to just how complex and interesting it is. The other point here, though, that's important, I think, in explaining its power is the fact that, you know, Ford doesn't leave very many notes, and it was very frustrating in some ways to research Ford's work on the film. But what I ended up was looking at the final shooting script versus what we actually see on the screen. And in six or eight important places, Ford eliminates dialogue, exposition, moments where you get explanations of why the characters are doing what they're doing. You know, the uncle fondling a photograph of his dead sister-in-law, so we know for sure he was in love with her and all that. Well, that's all gone. And so is the explanation of why Ethan doesn't kill Debbie at the end of the film. There's dialogue that explains that in the shooting script. Ford took it out. He replaces these things with visual narrative. You're watching him tell the story visually rather than with words. And at the same time, he leaves more ambiguity, because you have to decide why Ethan does what he does. You have to decide who's in love with who. You have to look at things and figure it out. And that gives it an extra layer, both of complexity and beauty, that I think was very attractive to these young visual filmmakers, and very and I think is one of the things that raises this movie to the level of real cinematic art, even for people who watch it today.
In some ways, it's the model of a great movie story, isn't it? I mean, it is in some ways the hero's journey, but the search, that's a very powerful cinematic device, or dramatic
device.
Well,
going right back in our mythology to to knights in shining armor, and even before that, the search is one of our most powerful themes. Absolutely. So it strikes a chord in us. It's very, very, very deep, I think.
Now, did you ever go out to Monument Valley?
Of course. Of course. I went out there in 2008. We stayed at Goulding's Lodge.
Ah.
We went, they have a number of tours. We went on all of them, but then we hired someone to help us find searcher spots, because they weren't really clued in to searchers as opposed to other films. So, you know, I just put together from photographs and things and got a Navajo guide, and he took us around and some people knew a little of this and that. So we saw a lot of things. The way Ford filmed in Monument Valley, he often just turned the camera around.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't cover the, 100 square miles. But he used the beauty. He knew where it was. He used the place that's called John Ford Point, named after him now. That's in the wonderful scene near the end of the film. Yeah, we went there. We looked at it all. Then we headed to Texas and saw the real thing. You know, there, Texas doesn't look anything like Monument Valley.
Not a bit, no.
But in a sense, you know, especially for those of us who didn't grow up there and think of Texas in mythic terms, it's sort of the vertical Monument Valley is the vertical version of Texas. It's the cinematic version. It's rough and tough and dry and parched and a little scary. Texas is relentlessly flat. Its only drama comes from the lack of drama of most of the terrain. But it's big and it's powerful. And so Ford, you know, just like Shakespeare, you know, uses the Globe Theater to tell stories about, you know, a prince from Denmark, Ford uses Monument Valley as his setting for these fables.
Sure.
And Monument Valley is just as beautiful in reality as it looks in The Searchers.
I was talking to a friend who lives in Arizona recently, and he said, when you live in Arizona and you know this, you know the terrain and The Searchers, you always think, you're only 5 miles from Olive Carey's house at any given time.
That's right.
The film,
that's right.
You know?
Sometimes you're just like, on the other side of it.
Yeah. It says, you know, they always act like they're searching far and wide, but
this
in
exactly.
fact, they're in this tiny little area, which is the magic of the movies, isn't it? But I've never been to Monument Valley. That's one of my new dream places. I got to go there,
Frank. You have to go to Monument
It really
Valley.
Is the dreamscape of the American cinema, and I'm such a location nut anyway that I just for some reason have never gone. So.
Well, one thing that's so interesting, of course, Ford shoots there for about 5 weeks, then he comes back, you know, to the RKO studio. We don't know what happened to the ending. We figure he probably shot an ending in Monument Valley, and maybe he shot the ending exactly the way it was in the final script. But then he comes back, and the last thing he does toward the end of shooting in the studio is he takes, you know, Natalie Wood and Wayne, and he takes them out to, you know, to Bronson, cave out in Griffith Park just down the road.
Yeah.
And shoots it again and shoots the ending that we actually see. And he doesn't care about continuity very much. You leave the flat plain in front of Monument Valley and the next thing you're in Bronson Cave heading up a hill with different terrain. Everything's different. Doesn't matter to John Ford. He's after something. I don't know why. If he shot something like that in Monument Valley and why he decided to redo it, there are no notes. Natalie Wood, John Ford, John Wayne, all the people involved in it have passed. It's one of those great mysteries to me, as to why he does that.
Yeah, Ford was frustrating about talking about his own work, and almost nobody ever got him to really talk frankly. Even the book-length interview with Peter Bogdanovich is as good as we're ever going to get,
yeah.
But he's still not real forthcoming about anything. It's just like he didn't want to. I think a lot of those guys, you know, Hawks and Wellman and Ford, Walsh, a lot of these guys wanted to keep this image of themselves as men of action and not men of emotion and not thinkers. They didn't really want to come off as being too brainy or too intellectual. This is just a job of work. This is what we do, you know.
It was a job of work. That's the way he described it. You know, when he appears with the directors, you know, when they have a meeting about whether to keep Joe Mankiewicz as the head of
sure.
the Directors Guild, he stands up finally and introduces himself to all these directors who know exactly who he is. He says, I'm John Ford and I make westerns. And that's all he wanted to say, you know, about who he was. That was his identity. But that's all he wanted to say. Just a job of work. I'm just a craftsman. I don't know about all this poet stuff. But the fact was, he was a poet. In a sense,
of course he was.
He sold himself short, but in a way that hurts him now, I think. Because, you know, the real fear with John Ford's work now is that a lot of young people aren't seeing it. They don't know who John Ford is.
Yeah.
And part of that is because he wouldn't talk about it. He had a lot to say. I'm sure he could have said a lot. He gives Bogdanovich little, you know, bones every now and then. He throws him a little something. But even with Bogdanovich, who he liked, I think, enormously, he was withholding, just as he withheld love from others. He withheld, you know, the truth sure. of the work he was doing from any interviewer. There are a couple of people I would have loved to have interviewed for this book, including John Wayne, who was apparently a lot of fun to interview, and I would have loved to have heard him. Alan LeMay, a couple of people. I'm not so sure I wanted to interview John Ford.
He wouldn't have done you much good.
I think he would have kicked me in the butt three or four times and, you know, laughed at me and just sent me away with nothing.
The irony about Ford, you were talking earlier about Andrew Saris and how he was championing directors who, up until the French discovered them, Hawks and Hitchcock primarily, and then later on Nicholas Ray and all these, Douglas Sirk and those guys. Unlike them, Ford was an incredibly honored director in America, but for his artistic films, The Informer, How Green Was My Valley, these are the Grapes of Wrath. These are what he got his awards for. He was really one of the most honored directors ever. And so it's really funny when he does start to cling to this, I'm just a, you know, I make Westerns, that's all I do. When in fact he's got a shelf full of Oscars for this poetic, really thoughtful, sometimes very intellectual work that he did. That's the dichotomy of Ford, I think.
The man won four Oscars for Best Director, more than any other director in the history of the Oscar. He won two more for the documentaries he made in the Navy during the war. He makes, you know, The Informer, which is a German expressionist movie. After watching the German expressionists, The Informer is one of the great expressionist
sure.
movies, I think. Early on, Ford, if you catch him before he becomes the persona, in the 1920s, there are a couple of interviews around the time, you know, of the, you know, where he talks about what he's doing and the grandeur of an epic, and why that's so important and why it's beyond just entertainment, that, you know, conjuring up America, and being the creator of something that's beyond entertainment, but that gets to our soul and the heart of who we are. So, you know, the Iron Horse. He reveals himself a little bit then, when he's a younger man, when his guard's down a little, when he's still proud and not quite as wary of everybody around him. But as Ford ages, I think as the alcoholism becomes more serious, as he has some bad experiences, partly because of that, disappointments, Ford moves into himself. He's very careful. He becomes more careful emotionally as time goes on, and that's the guy who isn't going to give you anything.
Well, I think it's also the way a wounded person acts. I will hurt myself before you have a chance to hurt me. I will, I'll put myself down because when you do it, I've already done it. So how does that hurt me? And I think there's a lot of that too. I think he was a man who had a great deal of unhappiness in his life. For whatever reason, I mean, it's looking at him from the outside, you think, well, gee whiz, how much more success, and artistically and commercially, how much more success could anybody want than he did? But that didn't seem to have much of an impact on him.
No. Well, he was troubled. It was hard work. He was challenged all the time. He felt he was responsible for all these people around him. No, he wasn't comfortable with it. I don't think I made quite enough of this in the book, in fact, of the fact that the complexity of The Searchers and the unsettling feeling you get watching it is because it reflects John Ford's psyche and his own unsettled feelings. He's 60 years old. This is the work of a mature artist, but someone who's wrestling, who's going deeper and deeper, and we're seeing all that trouble there on the screen. I think that's Ford, all the cross currents, all the conflicts, inner conflicts within him. And again, you know, aided by the alcoholism, which was a disease he could never conquer. All of that's going on, and we're seeing that played out in The Searchers.
Yeah, and you'll see it for the rest of his career. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance has some very dark undertones. Seven Women, gosh, what a bleak story that is. And even Cheyenne Autumn, which I think he meant as his apology, which is also nearly sunk by its really ill-conceived comic episodes, but
I have to agree with you there.
But there are also moments of great beauty in it, and yes. And it's also a very heartfelt film. But from The Searchers on, there's not much lightness in Ford at all.
Yeah, it's true. My problem with Cheyenne Autumn is the narrative goes slack. It's not storytelling with that same kind of tension. The great thing about Searchers is the narrative tension that drives it along and always kind of rescues it. You know, the only other thing I was thinking when we were talking about the humor and the community, it's the first third of Searchers that is probably, I would argue, the most perfect cinematic piece you can imagine, right up through, you know, when Brad dies and when they, and the turning of the earth speech. That's the end of the first third of the movie, and I think it's flawless. And later on we can argue about bits and pieces after that, but that first third, I've never seen anything like that in a Western or any other movie. I saw High Noon again a few weeks ago. It's a very good movie. And I saw Red River. They both have wonderful things in them. But really, for that first third, there's nothing that I can recall seeing that is as powerful and as successful in and of itself. And you're just driven forward by the narrative tension, which will play out over time in the rest of the film. And there you are.
Yeah, he's almost unique in his ability to do scenes that seem to be just about themselves, and yet are completely propelling the plot forward, and such moments of beauty in the composition. You know, I'm always struck by that opening scene where one by one the members of the family come out on the front porch, and they all go to exactly the right place, and then when the kid with the carrying the bundle of wood, as soon as he takes his place, which perfectly completes this little scene, Ford cuts because he doesn't want you to dwell. He doesn't want it to be what's the name? Like a painting. He doesn't he doesn't want it to be something that you look at like Griffith would have done. Hey, look at this. We're going to stop and
admire
pose
it for a while.
Moment. Yeah. As soon as that kid gets to, but he comes to exactly the right place, and everybody is posed precisely, and yet it never seems precise at all. It seems like they just walk out, and there they are, and but it starts that movie off with just this gust of beauty that never goes away. I mean that the. What you can say about The Searchers is that it is one of the most ravishing films in American cinema. And despite whatever the plot is, just looking at it is pure pleasure from start to finish. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, I agree. He really was a visual poet. And he works in this beautiful canvas. There's a moment... just before the turning of the earth speech, Brad's killed, and it's just the two of them, and they're out on the valley floor, and it looks, you know, it's an extraordinary painting, and yet, you know, it's real.
Mm-hmm.
It's the two of them in the foreground, and the whole valley stretching out before them. It's one of those jewels. Wynton Hawk said Ford was so good, he showed the jewels, but he didn't show them too often or too many of them. He'd just give you a little glimpse, and then the story would march on.
Yeah.
You know, it was never beauty for beauty's sake. It was always in the service of the plot. In the service, he gets those people out there, as you say, at the beginning, so you see that family out there. And then, not to put too fine a point on it, he kills them a few scenes later.
Sure.
And you know what's happened, and you feel that loss. I mean, I still weep when I think about that, you know, when I watch that moment, because of, you know what's coming, and there it is.
Sure. Yeah, it's a man. What a film that is, and what a book you've written. It's I must say, I always look askance at a book that's on a specific film, because I'm always afraid that it's going to be that academic, joy killing, jargon filled stuff. And this is a page turner, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And all the historical stuff about Cynthia Ann Parker and her son Guana Parker, who was one of the last Comanche chiefs, and that's all really fascinating stuff. And then all about how the film itself was made. It's just, if you like history, if you like movie history, this is a great book, and I thoroughly, heartily recommend it. And wish I could write one like that myself. Doubt if I ever will. Of course, I'm not a Pulitzer Prize winner, so what are you going to do?
Well, don't sell yourself short. I mean, that means a lot to me, Frank. I appreciate those words coming from you, especially. They're such great characters.
Sure.
You know, I really loved working on this book, as you can imagine. And I'm delighted, really gratified, that a lot of people have enjoyed it, have felt something. I think that's partly a tribute to the film. There's a reverence out there for the film. But also there's a real fascination with the Old West and with these mythological tales and where they come from. So I've managed to kind of, you know, tap into something that's very deep and very powerful with people. I feel the same way about it. And, you know, it was just a wonderful experience from beginning to end. And, you know, and I'm enjoying the experience of talking about it, of thinking about it. I've come out to L.A. where there are plenty of people out here who know a whole lot more about movies than I do. And I'm getting some great questions, you know, at book events. I'm getting some great opportunities to learn a little more. So it's been a great experience.
Do you think you're going to do another book on a film or of films in general?
I'm thinking about it. But it's really difficult to think of something that resonates so much with me.
Sure.
That I could live with it, do it well, bring something to it. There are many film books that I love. You know, Pictures of a Revolution, which came out a few years ago, about the five Academy Award nominees in 67. Mark Harris, I believe it is. And that's a wonderful book. I read that and said, boy, I wish I could have done this book. So there might be something out there. But right now I'm just trying to get around, talk to people, and think a little bit about what might come next. I ask everybody, well, what would you do if you were me next? So I should ask you too, Frank. What's the movie out there that begins to match Searchers that I can take on?
I'll just say, stay away from Bogest. I'm warning you. That's all.
Okay.
It's mine. Mine, I tell you.
Take it. It's yours.
Well, thanks a lot, Glenn. This has been great fun for me, and I really enjoyed your book and enjoyed talking to you.
Well, thank you, Frank. I had a great time too.
I thought that was a fascinating talk with Glenn Frankel, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed going through it. And I hope that you will find his book, and the best place to find it is on the Amazon link on my podcast page, thecommentarytrack.com. And if you go there, and if you order the book through there, then Glenn gets a sale, and I get a few pennies kickback from Amazon, and Amazon gets a sale, and the publisher's happy, and Amazon's happy, and Glenn's happy, and I'm happy, and you'll read this book, and you'll be happy. And by inference, as I've said before, the entire world will be happy. So, can you believe it? Just for the price of one book, you could bring total happiness to the entire world? How can you not do that? You'd have to be a really selfish monster not to do that. Can you live with yourself? Can you even look at yourself in the mirror after that? Listen, I'm getting disgusted. I don't want to talk about this anymore. If you don't buy this book through Amazon, I don't know what to say. I just don't know what to say. So let's move on. Let me thank my wonderful, beautiful wife, Claire McCullough Thompson, for being my announcer. And let me thank the great James Hutchins for building my websites, thecommentarytrack.com, frankthompson.tv. And as always, the composers of my wonderful and sometimes poignant theme music, Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand of Chicago, Illinois. Let's give them a hand, shall we? Neither one of those guys has a website. I've always regretted that because I always want to plug them in some way, but there's no way that I can do that. Rob occasionally records things, and but I don't even know how to point you toward those. So if you're ever in Chicago, look them up and say thank you for the great music that they provide for the commentary track. And so we will see you again next week. Have some great guests lined up, although, to tell you the truth, I don't know who's going to be on next week exactly. It's always a little bit of a mystery to me, and that's the way I like it. Life is an adventure, isn't it?
So join me again next week when we'll have another great guest. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.